Well, last week we learnt a new word, anti-fragile, which just means the opposite of fragile, the exact opposite of fragile. Some things are fragile, like this glass, and if you had hit this glass with a hammer, bad things would happen, okay? But actually, most things are fragile, not just glass. If I was hitting this pulpit with a hammer, it's not quite so fragile. But the more you hit it, the worse it would get. So it's sort of fragile in a sense. There are some things, though, that are the opposite of that. The more you hit them, the better they get. We thought about one thing last week. My sword. Steel is an example of something that if you put it in the fire, and then you take it out, and you bash it, and then you put it in cold water, and then you repeat the process, it actually gets stronger. It's anti-fragile. Here's another example of something that's anti-fragile. Oh, yuck. Do you know what happens if you put a lump of coal under extreme pressure? Do you know what happens? Perhaps you put it under the surface of the earth, for example. Some of us are wearing that on our fingers. Can we have it up on the screen, please? That's what happens. You might have to sort of cut it a little bit, but that's basically what happens. It turns into a diamond. The more pressure you put it under, coal, the more beautiful it becomes. And actually, also, diamond is the hardest material known to science. So the more pressure you put it under, the stronger it becomes and the more beautiful. That's what we mean by anti-fragile. Not weaker, but better, the more you hit it. Here's a few lines. I'm going to carry on, my friend. Here's a few lines from a novel. It's a description of a fictional character, but I think it makes the point. Even as hope seemed to die, it was turned to a new strength. He felt through all his limbs a thrill, as if he were turning into some creature of stone and steel, that neither despair, nor weariness, nor endless barren miles could subdue. Even as hope seemed to die, it was turned into a new strength. The question that Habakkuk asks for us is, what will pressure do to me? What will it do to me when I'm under pressure? What happens to me when hope seems to die? Will I go through my life fragile or anti-fragile? And the fact that God has given us this book shows us that what he wants for us, which of those two he wants for us, and also shows us the path to get there. In fact, everything that God says to this chap, Habakkuk, and everything he doesn't say to Habakkuk is tailored towards that end. All the answers that God gives him and all the answers he doesn't give him are designed to make him into something great, like a diamond. It's not so much designed to answer all of Habakkuk's questions, philosophical questions about suffering and injustice in the world. Those are good questions, but just not particularly what God is trying to answer in Habakkuk. It's designed to make Habakkuk anti-fragile, a person of greatness, so great that people will still be talking about him 2,500 years later in a country he'd never heard of. So what's the essence of the Lord's answer in chapter 2? Well, you'll see if you've got a notice sheet, I've put my best attempt to summarise it on there. If last week part 1 was God is very, very big, then this week, part 2, I am very, very small. And the Lord says three things to try and get that across to Habakkuk, to make him feel small, or more precisely, to make him feel really good about feeling small. And just to warn you in advance, we're going to spend more time on the first and the second one, just so you don't get very discouraged and you think, when is this going to end? Okay, so we'll spend more time on the first couple. First reason to feel good about feeling small is to say, I can't understand the plan, but I can trust the person. Let's just trace this through. So if you look at verse 1 of chapter 2, from last week, verse 1 of chapter 2, Habakkuk sort of sets himself to wait for the answer. He says at the end, I'll stand at my watch. I will look to see what he will say to me. And then, verse 2, the Lord replied, at last. At last Habakkuk's going to get his answer. And it sounds like it's going to be a pretty thorough answer in detail, because the first thing God says to him is pretty much, you might want to get a pen for this. You see there in verse 2, write down the revelation. And also make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. Tablets, heralds, that's the mass media of the day, the ancient equivalent of internet and newspapers. So God is saying, I want this to go viral, okay? So it's like, drum roll, please. The great revelation you've been waiting for, the answer you've all been waiting for is, what is it? Verse 3. Wait and see. Trust me, wait and see. If you wanted verse 3 in 5 words, it'd be that. Trust me, wait and see. Can you imagine what verse 3 must have done to Habakkuk to hear? The revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end. It won't prove false, though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. It's all very well saying that the answer will come on time, but that time's not now, and I want it now. How is trust me, wait and see, an answer? How is that even an answer to my questions? Who would give that answer to someone they care about? Well, maybe there's the answer. Many of us here know what it's like having young children. I don't, but as far as I can tell anyway, there are some things that no matter how hard you try to explain them, they just simply, you cannot understand that aged 5 or something. No matter how hard I try and explain to them, they're just not big enough to understand that. And really all you can do in that situation is say to them, please trust me, wait and see. I guess talk to any parent here tonight over tea and coffee afterwards, and they'll probably give you a dozen examples of that just from the last week, probably. What do we think it would do to a child? How long would they survive if a parent only ever did things for them that they could ask for and fully understand? How long would they last? What does a child need more, to learn to understand all the plans that I make, or to learn to trust the parent? Sometimes, trust me, wait and see, is the kindest thing you can say. It really is. And here's the thing, if that can be true between a child and an adult, where actually the gap is very, very small compared to the vast gap between us and God, if that can be true between a child and an adult, why can I simply just not believe that it could be true between me and God? That it's just not possible that sometimes the kindest thing God can do is to say, trust me, wait and see. If so, if that's the case, the problem really boils down to this, doesn't it? The problem is we just hate being small. I don't want to be told that I'm like a 5-year-old when I look out at the problems of the world, the decisions we have to make, the intractable problems there seem to be. I don't want to be told that I'm like a 5-year-old. How insulting to come to church this evening and be told by some guy that I am not God's equal. How insulting. You know, I'm savvy, I'm hardworking, smart. I can fix anything if I put my mind to it. If what God is doing doesn't make sense to me, then what God is doing can't be right. That's how I feel sometimes. Am I the only one who feels like that? We hate feeling small, don't we? We hate it. And yet, isn't it true, if we think about it, that that is the cause of so much of the anxiety and the stress in our lives? Michelle said earlier, it feels like a ball and chain around our feet, feeling that we have to be able to figure things out the whole time, thinking that I know better than God. I'm smart enough to see the end from the beginning and trace it through. You know, I know that if this happens, then that will happen, and then that won't happen, and then that will happen, and then life won't be worth living. But how do I know that? I don't know those things. Even the very wisest can't see all ends. But here I am freaking out because, well, I guess I assumed that I was omniscient. I knew everything. If X happens, and then Y doesn't happen, then Z will happen, and then that's the end of the line, isn't it? And then we sort of get round and round in a loop on that thing. You're like a computer goes round and round in a loop. I guess that's how it crashes, isn't it? I don't know, but I've seen that's how a computer crashes, how you get a blue screen of death on a computer, for those of us old enough to remember that. And it all basically happens because I just feel that I know better than God. I'm big and he's small. And that's the attitude that the Lord is trying to deal with here in Habakkuk. Because he loves Habakkuk. He says to him, write this down on tablets and get it out there. Wouldn't life be much better if you had someone you could just trust and say, do you know what, I trust you. Put your hand in theirs and you'll get me home. There's a great old hymn. Guide me, O thou great Redeemer, pilgrim through this barren land. How's it go next? I am weak, but thou art mighty. Hold me with thy powerful hand. I am weak, but thou art mighty. Hold me with thy powerful hand. And the other reason I love that hymn is because it's written by a guy called William Williams, which is just a great name, isn't it? William Williams. I love that. So next time you're in your loop or the blue screen of death, just ask, what would William Williams say to me? That's our first reason. First reason Habakkuk gives to feel really good about feeling small. Second reason, we'll spend most of our time left on this. God basically says, look what happens otherwise. Look what happens otherwise. Take a good honest look and see what happens when God is small and people are big. Oh, we can have a diamond down now, I think. Thanks very much. Being there the whole time. When God is small and people are big. That'll be a good description of the Babylonians. We met them last week, the Babylonians. See there in verse 4. See, he is puffed up. Puffed up. Puffed up means to pretend to be bigger than you really are. To inflate myself. Usually via means of large quantities of hot air. So verse 4, they make themselves big as they can. And if you turn over to verses 18 to 20, they make their gods as small as possible. Verses 18 to 20, which I take it are meant to be kind of comic satire. For example, verse 19, the idea of saying to wood, come to life. It's like a little child with a doll, isn't it? You know, he picks it up and you move it around and then you make your doll say funny things in funny voices. That's what children do. Or maybe not just children. We all do that with God. Because it's very useful to have a God who always agrees with you and never disagrees with you. You know, who always seems to do just what I want him to. Very convenient. So verses 18, 19, God is small. And then verse 4, I'm big. And the stuff in between, those two, 4 and 18, is basically saying, look what happens when that's the case. Look what happens when you do that. For one thing, it breaks me. It breaks me. See verses 4 and 5. The problem with being puffed up, problem with lots of hot air, is it makes you kind of like a balloon. And a balloon is A, empty at the center, and B, fragile, extremely fragile. So I always feel kind of vulnerable, never at rest. That's what it says in the second line of verse 5. It says he's arrogant, puffed up, and so never at rest. Because I know that anything could come along any time and puncture my ego, and that'll be the end of me. I'm like a balloon. And nothing I do, no matter how hard I try, can ever fill up that space and make me strong again. See the end of verse 5. Even if someone is as greedy as the grave, and like death is never satisfied, even if I could gather to myself all the peoples and take them all captive, have them all kind of bow down and worship me and tell me how great I am, even then I was still full empty in the center and fragile. That's what happens when we put ourselves in God's shoes. We're not big enough to fill God's shoes. So I suppose I'm bound to ask us tonight, what are the things that we look to fill us up and make us strong? For the Babylonians, it was military conquest and domination. For us, it will be something different, I guess, anyway. But it will be something. There's a great tennis player in the 70s and 80s, Chris Evert, and she won 18 Grand Slams. After retiring, though, she said this, "I had no idea who I was anymore or what I could be away from tennis. I was depressed and afraid because so much of my life had been defined by being a tennis champion. I was completely lost. Winning made me feel like a somebody. It made me feel pretty. It was like being hooked on a drug. I needed the wins, the applause, in order to have an identity." Quite sad to hear, isn't it? But it's very honest. And I need to ask myself, as I ask you, what's my equivalent of winning tennis matches? What makes me feel like a somebody? What makes me feel pretty? What would make me depressed and afraid if I lost it? What do I look to for applause when I'm feeling down? It's likely to be something very, very good in and of itself. It could be a relationship or a career or a shiny new car or a gadget. It could be knowing my Bible well or preaching. It could be anything. Do you know what that is for you? That is the most profound self-awareness that we can have, to know the particular things that my heart turns to stop me feeling fragile and empty on the centre, the particular things my heart turns to. So when God is small and I'm big, I break myself. But it doesn't stop there, I'm afraid. I also break other people. That's largely what verses 6 to 17 are saying, in very broad brushstrokes. It's a picture of what happens when you take people who are arrogant, never at rest, never have enough, and then you let them loose in a world containing these sort of things. Things like money, verses 6 to 8, and power, verses 9 to 14, and sex, verses 15 to 16. Money, power, and sex. How do you think those things would function in the hands of people who are fragile and desperately empty in the centre? What would it feel like to live in a world like that? Especially if I was weak and vulnerable, what would happen to me? Would people look after me in that world? Verse 6 is actually put in the mouths of the victims of the Babylonians. So the victims are people were used and abused. And these people are looking ahead to when the Babylonian Empire finally falls. Finally, they watch the Babylonians fall and suffer. And what are they doing? They're laughing and taunting. You have to really hate someone, don't you, to laugh when they're suffering. But that's the level of hatred I generate when I use money, power, sex against people, not for them. Now, Babylonians did that in a very obvious, kind of global, public way. But is it possible we can do the same exact thing, just in a more kind of subtle, more sort of acceptable, socially acceptable way? When I meet someone, what do I think? Do I think to myself deep down, in my heart of hearts, how can I make this person more happy, more secure, more safe? Do I think that, or do I think to myself, calculate to myself how they can help me, my quest to feel like a somebody and to feel pretty, to feel the applause? When I make myself big and God small, I break myself, I break other people. Verse 17, over the page, verse 17, I also break the world. It says, "The violence you've done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of animals will terrify you." So flora and fauna get used and abused in my quest to make myself a somebody. And just finally, not only do we break ourselves, we break other people, break the world, but we also break everything we make. See, it's possible, someone might say in response to this, well, you know, okay, yeah, I see we do a lot of damage, but you have to break some eggs to make an omelette, don't you? You know, it's a real shame. It is a shame that we hurt people, we hurt ourselves and the world, but That's the price you pay for progress, isn't it? We'll just have a look, if you would, at verse 8. Because you've plundered many nations, the people who are left will plunder you. Or verse 11. The stones of the wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. Or verse 13. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire, that nations exhaust themselves for nothing? Which all basically ways of saying that if I build something out of pride or greed or lust or envy, whatever I build out of those sort of things, God will make sure that it falls down. And he'll make sure that I see that it falls down. And I will have exhausted myself for nothing. Surest way to waste a life. I'll have broken myself, other people, and the world. I have nothing to show for it. Why is God saying this? Why is he saying it to Habakkuk? It is because he loves him. He loves Habakkuk. Please don't go this way. All of us have that same Babylonian heart inside us. Me big, God small. Makes us fragile. Everything we build, fragile. And God doesn't want that for us. Look what happens when God is small and I'm big. Final point. Third way God helps Habakkuk feel small and feel good about feeling small. Look what happens when God is big and people are small. We get just a glimpse of that at the end of verse 4. End of verse 4. But the righteous will live by faith. It's less than half a verse, very easy just to zip past it, very small little phrase. And I don't know if Habakkuk realized how important those words would be. But the New Testament, later on, quotes them again and again. And if you wanted a really, really detailed explanation of those few words, the righteous will live by faith, let's say you wanted 16 chapters, maybe 16 divinely inspired chapters of explanation, well, you're in luck. It's called the Book of Romans. It quotes Habakkuk 2, verse 4 at the beginning, and then goes on to unpack in quite some detail how precisely faith in Jesus Christ lets me live. So it explains how faith in Jesus Christ lets me live, first of all, most importantly, live with God. The only way to be justified and forgiven, as we heard from the guys earlier. How to live with God. But then Romans explains how faith in Jesus Christ helps me to live with myself, my own inner world, deal with the fragileness and the emptiness at the center. And then it explains how faith in Jesus Christ lets me live with other people. So using power and money especially to give and to heal, not to take and destroy. Even with people I wouldn't naturally get on with at all. Then Romans explains even how faith in Jesus Christ lets me live with the natural world. It speaks about creation itself groaning, longing for people to bow the knee to Jesus Christ. And it also explains how faith in Jesus Christ gives me purpose. Lets me live with eternity, if you like. Gives me things to do with my life that actually matter and will last, but they won't break in eternity. It's all there, in a nutshell, in Habakkuk 2, verse 4. The basic idea, though, is if I let myself be small and God be big, everything will start to come right in my life and around me. If I would let Jesus Christ be the hero and stop trying to be the hero myself, everything, relationship with God, with myself, with other people, with the world, with eternity. Now, I don't know how much of that Habakkuk could have seen at the time. I suspect not very much. But by the end of chapter 2, he could definitely see two things. God is very, very big, uncomfortably big. I am very, very small, uncomfortably small. But if you put those two uncomfortable things together, actually you end up with something very comfortable to rest in. This is not a recipe for a life of kind of groveling, fear, and misery. Quite the opposite. It's a recipe for becoming anti-fragile. I am weak, but thou art mighty. Hold me with thy powerful hands. Now, there's a third part to it next week that really kind of makes those two kind of things ignite. But that's plenty for now. I'm going to finish there, and Nick is going to come and lead us in some prayers and in response.